Well, we've been giving you a few things of advice from the old farmer. Here's a few more. Words that soak into your ears are whispered, not yelled. Meanness doesn't just happen overnight. And forgive your enemies. It messes with their heads. I like those. We've been studying in our series on the face-to-face encounters with Jesus. And we've been blessed to revisit some amazing stories that make us, frankly, a little jealous. What self-respecting believer in Jesus Christ wouldn't give his right thumb to have the chance to walk in the shoes of just one of those first century citizens who were blessed to communicate face to face with the Son of God? Interesting to me. Don't get me wrong, we have some things much better than they had it. And I'm not talking about the modern technologies that we take for granted or our wealth or our speed of transportation and communication around the world. Like Randy mentioned recently about living in the days before the microwave oven, I've lived the slow life. I enjoy the speed of life, the fastness. I prefer that. We just got back from our trip to Tennessee to see family last night, and I'm glad it only took 4.5 hours. I mean, imagine the difference. So how clueless they must have been in the first century while Jesus was walking around in Galilee, and they were unaware of the cross and the resurrection to come, just to name a couple of massive examples. Could we name many more? And surely if we went around the room developing a list of other things that each one thinks of, oh, they didn't know this, they didn't know that. Those first-hand witnesses that they could have benefited more had they known what we know, what we've read and studied, because the word is in a collected body now. For instance, imagine if all of Jesus' audience would have known while he's teaching the Sermon on the Mount, let's say, would have known of the Roman centurion at his crucifixion to say, this was the Son of God. Had they known when he's teaching early on in his ministry? In fact, let's just let Matthew give us a sweet little list of spectacular things leading up to this proclamation that the Roman centurion proclaimed. In Matthew 27, beginning with verse 50. Matthew 27, verse 50 to 54. And Jesus cried again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. What happened then, Matthew? Number one, verse 51. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in two. For those of you who have my vocabulary, that means torn. Rent in two from the top to the bottom. Study that a little deeper if you haven't already. We won't go too deeply, but ask a few questions about that. How tall was that veil in the temple? What did it veil? What did it separate in the temple? How did it tear from top to bottom after all the centuries of this never happening before? Just to name a few, that's good stuff, folks. What else happened when Jesus gave up his spirit? Verse 51, the earth did quake and the rocks were rent or broken. That would get my attention since I've never experienced a real live earthquake before. Number three, verse 52, and the tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints that had fallen asleep were raised. Who might these saints have been? I'd like to know these questions. Don't we wish we had some names? And coming forth out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were done, feared exceedingly, saying, truly, this was the Son of God. What had they seen? Enough, right? And then again, if only the centurion and his detailed soldiers knew, when this statement was made about the empty tomb that would happen 3 days later. If they knew better, the verb tense in his quote would have been said more like we say it today. Surely this is the Son of God. Because there is no death in this scenario. He is alive. No doubt the audience of Jesus would have been astounded if they could have been shown the future a short 3 to 4 years later after his ministry was over. Truth be told, I might give my right thumb and my right big toe to have been one of those firsthand witnesses. Now, maybe you disagree, but can you just imagine? So, contrast the face-to-face with the Son of God as opposed to the voice of God at the giving of the Old Testament law. Remember, Moses, you speak to us lest we die. It's a big contrast. And people were thronging Jesus to get the chance to be there and see him face to face. Today we want to examine one of the face-to-face encounters with a person Jesus didn't seek out. And to recap, 2 weeks ago we visited the woman with the issue of blood. And I called her the hitchhiker on the road to Jairus' house, a dying daughter of the synagogue official required such urgency, you'd think, right? But we had a hitchhiker that slowed the process. But because she had the faith to be healed without so much as a request made to Jesus, Jesus stopped the crowded train of people to point out a clear miracle. By all rights, in my view, she would have gone away rejoicing in silence, being healed of her terrible 12-year malady. Just think of our subject today. Jesus didn't seek the woman out either. It would seem that she was just circumstance as far as Jesus was concerned. Earlier in our studies, we noticed the woman at the well. I think the timing was obvious that he meant to be there at the right time to introduce himself as the Messiah, whom she wondered, when is he coming? Now we turn to John chapter 8. And a side note, last week Billy had a spectacular lesson on my favorite Bible topic of all time, the angel of the Lord. Billy referenced the 8th chapter of John at the end of the chapter, and his verse that he looked at was John 8, 58 through 59, where Jesus said, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. And Billy didn't take time to point out the reaction he got for this statement that he made about saying, I am. If there is any mystery in our minds what Jesus meant by such a claim, the Jewish leaders knew exactly what he was saying. Verse 59, therefore they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. Were they just going to have a rock battle? You know, like kids? No, they picked up stones because he deserved death in their view. The Jews knew Jesus was claiming his own place in deity by saying, I am. And the Jews knew the story of Moses and the burning bush that was not consumed. They were very familiar with the statement made by the angel of the Lord. And when Moses asked, who shall I tell them sent me? I am that I am. What that means and what a statement it is I have always, always existed. So the Jews realized Jesus was so bold as to claim he has always existed No one but God could make such a claim. Blasphemy in their eyes. Blasphemy. So the rocks were picked up in the latter part of the chapter, which is funny to me, kind of interesting that this chapter covers some rock battles. We move back to the first part of the chapter, John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, and early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people were coming to him, and he sat down and began teaching them. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, and having set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act." What a qualifier, wouldn't you say? Verse 5, "Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say?" And this reminds me of another conversation Jesus had with the lawyer, who tried to trip Jesus up on the most important laws from the Mosaic law. And Jesus' response was, "How do you read it? How do you read it? Isn't it reassuring, if not comical, that Jesus, in his wisdom, allowed the lawyer a bit of grace? He knew what his motives were, but he allowed him a little bit of grace. He allowed him to explain his view of a black and white law. Black and white. There's no middle. There's no gray. Now, the law was law. There was one way for it to be interpreted. That's God's way. And Jesus could have been boisterous about it. In the voice of the gangster frog on the cartoon when I was growing up, "This is the way it's going to be, see?" He could have been boisterous. He could have been said, "Well, it doesn't matter what you think. This is the way it is." If I were the Son of God, and I'm not, if I were the Word, as he is called by the writer John, and by all scriptural rights, I am the one responsible for creation, and I was the lawgiver in the first place, I'd be matter of fact. Here's the answer. I'd be boisterous with absolute truth on my side. No one could question me. No one could debate the issue of black and white law that I gave in the first place. It's his law. Yet, I'm not the Son of God. I'm not God. I'm not the Son of God or the Creator. And Jesus was the meek and lowly for good reason. Boisterousness wasn't needed because the checkmate was coming later with the lawyer and everyone else. So let's get back to this. We continue with the potential death penalty of an adulterous woman. And I have questions. Some of my questions are for the purpose of painting the scene with a few more details, if we dare to do so. Was this a regular occurrence for the Jewish leadership to engage in? I mean, were citizens often finding their neighbors in the very act of sins on a regular basis and turning them into the synagogue? How did they know that she was caught in the very act? Were they eyewitnesses? Seems kind of sketchy to me if they were. Who actually brought the accusation against her? And this begs another question. Where is the other guilty party? Interesting. Interestingly enough, Jesus didn't ask any of those questions that I'm asking. And I could draft more of those. The leadership of the Jews was quick to introduce this grand jury, shining a spotlight on the law in case Jesus wasn't familiar, perhaps. And another side note, when you listen to the news, what are you getting from a news story? How much of the story are you getting? What did the, air quotes here, reputable news reporter leave out of the story that he or she is relaying to you? And how much trust should we place in the source of the story? Ronald Reagan said concerning the leader of Russia, concerning the arms race, trust but verify. That's a pretty good standard to go by. Is there any way to corroborate what has just been told by the news reporter? There is the problem we have with these Jewish leaders in this primetime news story. Is there a way to corroborate? Is it wise to accept the report as true based on the news report we've just received? Jesus apparently didn't seem to think so, and John revealed to us their real motives. Therefore, it was easy to conclude what Jesus determined about their motives. And I find it is good policy to follow in our time. It's biblical. Here's some Bible for you. Matthew chapter 7, 15 through 16. Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. And if you're listening to a news reporter or a Bible teacher, the premise is the same. 1 Thessalonians 5 and 21, prove all things, examine everything carefully, New American Standard. Hold fast that which is good. Abstain from the very form of evil. Incidentally, this is the way that I troubleshoot mechanical issues. If there is a system which requires electricity to operate, it is important to verify the voltage readings along the system. Those of you who know, you know. And you get nowhere assuming those voltage readings are just there. You have to prove it. And so if someone says something, then let's prove that before we assume it's true. Well, the woman's accusers brought the law into it. What does the law actually say? The good thing is Jesus didn't have to stress about that. He didn't have to stroll over to the synagogue and study up on it. He knew the law. Here is the Old Testament law on adultery, including what the scribes and Pharisees reported. Leviticus 20 and verse 10. If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Did the scribes and Pharisees, going by what we just read there, did the scribes and Pharisees leave any important bits out? So don't miss this, Deuteronomy 19 and 15. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. The fact of the matter is, as far as God is concerned, this reading in Deuteronomy 19 wasn't some antiquated law that we just leave back there just to be under the law of Moses. It transcends into the New Testament as well. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. Later in John chapter 8 and verse 17, Jesus refers to the Old Testament law, I believe, pointing out the error to the accusers in their weak test of Jesus, if you will. John chapter 8 and verse 17, even in your law it has been written that the testimony of two men is true. Paul wrote in Corinth, in 2 Corinthians 13 and 1, this is the third time I'm coming to you. Every fact is to be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Also, he wrote of the proper way to deal with an elder who gets out of line. Careful, elders, we got our eyes on you. Verse 19, 1 Timothy 5, verse 19, do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses. Those who continue in sin rebuke in the presence of all, so that the rest also may be fearful of sinning. Do you think God's trying to get a message across from cover to cover? I think so. So the Jewish leaders were testing Jesus, but they were like the dog. And if you know the statement I'm about to say it out loud. The dog with a loud bark, he was all bark and no bite. So we move on. Verse 6. That was kind of weak, by the way, audience. And they were saying this, testing him, in order that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. Well, put a bookmark there. So much has been said concerning the writing of our Lord in the dust. Too much speculation may be harmful sometimes, but it might interest you what some have thought. How interesting it is, though, and this is fact, how interesting it is that John here is the only New Testament writer to ever indicate that Jesus wrote anything, physically wrote anything, which is fascinating. And this writing in the dust seems such a waste. I mean, you think about just how valuable that would be today. Surely anything that Jesus wrote would be a bestseller. And then again, the Bible has topped the bestseller list for years. How many years? Well, Guinness Book of World Records gives us this. The best-selling book of all time in the Christian is the Christian Bible. It is impossible to know exactly how many copies have been printed in roughly 1,500 years since its contents were standardized. But research conducted by the British and the Foreign Bible Society in 2021 suggests that the total number probably lies between 5 and 7 billion, with a B, copies. Now, don't let the national debt that's in the, 30-something trillion dollars diminish this number of 5 to 7 billion copies. Remember, a billion is 1,000 million. So we're talking serious numbers here. The fact that they stopped including the Bible on normal bestseller lists is astounding. Imagine the Bible, God's Word, has been given a handicap to compete with all the other authors who publish books, just to make it fair. But these words that Jesus wrote in the dust with his finger would never make the print. And those words in the dust would merely be trampled by men outside the temple shortly after being written. And yet, is that not what we do with God's Word on a daily basis? By our actions, by our apathy, and through our sins, we just trample his words, just like the ones he wrote in John chapter 8, in the dust. Someone had the idea that Jesus was writing the names of scribes and Pharisees' mistresses. That's a thought, something to think about. Meaning, if true, they were guilty of doing the same sin they accused this woman of. Well, were they hypocrites? He called them such other places. Even if they were not adulterers, Jesus will address their sins in this grand jury. I've also heard it speculated that Jesus wrote the name of the guilty party who was not brought forth of the same condemnation. At any rate, there is a secret that we will just have to ask when we get to heaven, if we even care to know by then. Kaufman did write this in his commentary: their partiality, not bringing their partner, makes it possible to suppose that one of them was the guilty man. And then he indicates adultery being referred to here indicates the woman was married. And Kaufman also mentioned that the scribes and the Pharisees were misapplying this law, or at least the punishment for the adultery, that being of stoning. And if you read the text for what it's actually saying, he may be correct. Leviticus 20 and 10 refers to this brand of adultery as punishable by death, but the mode of capital punishment is not specified. It's just not really written. If you can find it, let me know. I haven't seen it. The type of adultery where stoning is specified is mentioned in Deuteronomy 23 and 22, where an engaged girl before her marriage, in that case, both the man and the girl were to be stoned to death. Regardless, the death penalty in either case was to be carried out. In verse 7, when they persisted in asking him, which is interesting, King James uses the language continued asking him. So how long did they persist? I'd love to have been a fly on the wall and to see that. He straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Verse 8, and then again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. I can just see the baseball card collectors salivating over this document that he would have written had he used some cardstock. Imagine the price of an original Jesus Christ autographed, what it would have brought. And then again, we trample the words of Jesus like it was in the dust. How do you picture the scene after these words? "He who is without sin, start chucking rocks like Ernest T. Bass." I mean, really? Do you think there could have been heard from Jesus' followers some oohs and ahs? Ah, he got them. Or a little trash talking, like a pickup game of basketball. Or do you think possibly you could hear a pin drop? Do you think that maybe some were of the opinion, as were some previously, "What manner of man is this? He speaks not as the scribes." Maybe some thought, "No man has ever challenged the Jewish leaders with such wisdom and authority." Surely someone could truthfully ask if Solomon's wisdom had just been outdone. Bookmark that. Have you noticed that Billy and I could have included face-to-face meetings with the Pharisees and the scribes or the lawyers? And this story John reveals to us may be considered a face-to-face with them on this occasion. However, as I read the body language of Jesus, I picture his focus on no one else but the sinful woman accused. Just imagine the snub Jesus is giving them to not look them in the eyes with respect and honor, the very action that they requested, that they demanded each day. "Look at me, look at me." In fact, Jesus even spoke of this attitude, possibly when he described how they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments, and they love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called by men rabbi. Instead of standing in respect for the Jewish leaders, he stooped. He stooped down twice, opposite of what they would have requested. So no, this meeting that they barged in and demanded with Jesus had no invitation from the Son of God, and they gained no traction with him in the least. In fact, it left them looking very small in the eyes of his followers. Watch what happened next, verse 9. Which makes my point. "And when they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones." Are you keeping score? Pharisees, 0. The Son of God, 100, or whatever number you want to put on it. Complete victory, a blowout win. Verse 9, the latter part of verse 9, "And he was left alone and the woman where she was in the midst. And straightening up, Jesus said to her, 'Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?' And she said, 'No one, Lord.' And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Go your way. From now on, sin no more. Now, maybe you're like I have been, sort of taking this story for granted. Oh, she was never going to be stoned to death anyway. It was never going to happen. What makes anyone conclude this? Well, maybe it's because we take her safety for granted because we've read the story countless times over our lives. We've just kind of glossed over it. How can we gloss over this story, right? Truth be told, was she worried? Did she feel ashamed? I'd say so. You can just imagine as she is being dragged through the city streets, she was thinking today would be, she would breathe her last. What was I thinking? What was I thinking giving in to that temptation? Today I'm going to die. And I may be the only one who's ever brought up the elephant in the room, but here goes. Those of us in the audience who have been the spouse hurt by similar actions of this woman's adultery may be thinking she deserved to be stoned. What about the innocent spouse? How did he feel? Was he there at her impromptu trial? You know what, though? Before any of us had been personally affected by this sin against God and their marriages, we probably never gave a second thought to that. After all, it's about perspective, isn't it? We were just thankful that this poor woman, guilty as she wasn't punished that day at the steps of the temple or some other place. Her public shaming was surely enough. Maybe that's what we thought before we were hurt by the same. So this story, this true story revealed to us by John, is short, but it can be viewed from several perspectives. And so we have a very significant face-to-face with Jesus that hits home to us 20-plus centuries later. Why does it? What is so significant about this one story that impacts us so much, that catches our attention every time it's brought up? I did a little reading about the death penalty for adultery, which brought up a great deal of history of what different societies thought concerning or about continuing the practice as God specified in the Old Testament law. And if any of you scholars know more about this, I'd love to hear more. But just spending a little time on it, the major consensus was that it should not be a capital offense as it was under the Jewish law. Just look at our society. Except for the retaliation of a spouse, you hear it in the news, who took the law into his own hands, the death penalty hasn't been implemented in society for this sin for a long time, for centuries in most cases, and probably the Arab nations likely being the exception. Is it possible that all societies have had the same thought as the older ones to the younger ones as they departed because they knew they're guilty of sin as well? Now back to the face-to-face with where Jesus showed the woman mercy. In this instance, Jesus is re-emphasizing a statement he made 5 chapters earlier to Nicodemus. John chapter 3, verse 17, for God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world should be saved through him. So how would it be? How would it be if Jesus would have said, okay, I'll throw the first stone? After all, I am the Son of God. I am the I am. Harmony with John chapter 3 and verse 17 would have been difficult, right? Judgment will be done by him at the second coming, but Jesus brought the goods of redemption at his first visit. And this woman's face-to-face with him may be the best example of the manifestation of that mercy. Really, though, have we answered the question from earlier? What about this story is so significant that we want a great deal of questions answered. If they had followed the law correctly, bringing both guilty parties, would Jesus have handled it any differently? Would Jesus, the Word, the original lawgiver, in my view, have disobeyed the Old Testament law to avoid breaking the Roman law, restricting the Jews from taking out or exercising capital punishment? So many questions. And if you don't get anything from my classes, you will get more questions. Ultimately, we're so intrigued by this story, whether we admit it or not, because we are the poor, sinful woman caught in the very act, whether it's that sin or another. At least John reported that the older leaders were said to have walked away, showing their convictions of their own sins. And I think that just says we're all guilty. A class of this size makes me think there must be a mixture of different attitudes in the audience. You never know, right? Much like we see in this face-to-face with Jesus in John chapter 8. You have your accusers, the finger pointers. You have the law reciters. It says in the law, this is it, black and white. And you have the guilty as charged. At one point or another, we fill all three pairs of shoes. And when we look to this face-to-face with Jesus, and we look through the eyes of the adulterous woman, or whatever sin we're prone to, does it help us draw back our fingers and point with our thumbs? Jesus met several folks who accused him of some terrible things, who picked up rocks to stone him. Surely some of those were of the repentant hearts in the book of Acts that realized their errors in Acts chapter 2. Men and brethren, what shall we do? As if to say, what have we done? What shall we do? So what is your dream, as we close, what is your dream of your first face-to-face with the original lawgiver? What do you think you'll say? What do you think you'll do? Will you even be able to look on his face when you see him just as he is? And yet, feelings only get us so far. Our feelings will make us more confident if they're backed up with soulful, prayerful actions of obedience and a steady walk with him in his footprints. Sweetly, Lord, have we heard thee calling, come, follow me. And we see where thy footprints falling lead us to thee. Though they lead over the cold, dark mountains, seeking his sheep, or along by Siloam's fountains, helping the weak. If they lead through the temple holy, preaching the word, or in homes of the poor and lowly, serving the Lord. Then at last, when on high he sees us, our journey done, we will rest where the steps of Jesus end at his throne. Footprints of Jesus that make the pathway glow. We will follow the steps of Jesus wherever they go. Really? Do we really believe that? It is definitely our challenge, isn't it? And so to copy the words of Jesus, and I'll end with this, go and sin no more. What a challenge. The class is yours. I appreciate your attention. Thank you so much. Hey, look at that.